You ready, Lori?
Yeah.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee on Wednesday, June 19th. We have quite a diverse group of issues and a diverse group of legislators to talk about them. So we're going to begin by opening a public hearing and work session on House Concurrent Resolution 33. Lori, could you tell us what this one is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 33 commends the 2012 Gresham National Little League team for earning its first berth in Little League Baseball World Series. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the measure, and it moved off the House floor with 57 ayes and 3 excused.
Thank you, Lori. And I see that we've been joined by Senator Lori Montes Anderson, and she looks excited about the Little League.
Oh, thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for hearing this bill. And I am so excited to bring HCR 33 to your attention. In August 2012, the Gresham Barlow Little League team made its first ever appearance in the Little League Baseball World Series after winning the championship game of the Northwest Regional Tournament in an 8-4 victory over Post Falls Little League in San Bernardino, California. And then during the summer of 2012, the Gresham National Little League team won district and state champions and secured its spot in the regional championship game with a 6-2 win over top seed Mercer Island Little League in one semifinal game. And as the only fourth team from Oregon to earn a berth in the Little League Baseball World Series, Gresham National Little League's team played hard on August 18th in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, but ultimately lost to Par Troy East Little League. This is one of the most exciting things that happen in a community. And I remember Gresham as a little town, but now it's a city over 100,000. But it still had that small town atmosphere when Gresham Little League won and went to finals. So I would hope that you would recognize my 2012 Gresham Little League team by adopting HCR 33.
Great. Thank you for your testimony and for bringing this to us. Any questions for Senator Montes Anderson? Okay.
Thank you very much,
and we'll let you get back to your other committee. Members, we are in a work session. Senator Starr?
I'd move the House Concurrent Resolution 33 be actually sent to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved HCR 33 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing Senator Ferriola, did you want to vote on the Little League? We are just moving HCR 33 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. I just said any objection to the motion?
No objection.
We're not objecting. So the motion on HCR 33, honoring the Gresham Little League, carries unanimously and moves to the floor, and we'll ask Senator Montes Anderson to carry it on the floor. And so now we have everybody here, and I think we've got 5 minutes before we have a judge scheduled by telephone, so let's see what we can do about redistricting. Okay. So next I'll open a public hearing on
2887.
On House Bill 2887A. And Lori, could you tell us what this is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2887A prescribes a process for adjudicating reapportionment of congressional district. It forms a panel of judges to decide reapportionment in an event that the Legislative Assembly fails to enact reapportionment or upon petition challenging reapportionment enacted by the Legislative Assembly. There's no revenue impact. There's a fiscal statement issued, which is attached hard copy to your SMS.
And it looks like we have the chair of the House Rules Committee here to testify. And so if you'd like to come forward, Representative Garrett. And welcome to Senate Rules.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Chris Garrett, State Representative from District 38 with Oswego, Southwest Portland. Thank you for taking up this bill today. I'm going to introduce it briefly, and I know that John DiLorenzo is here in the room to speak to it in more detail. The purpose of this bill is to fill a void that currently exists in Oregon statute regarding how to resolve disputes over redrawing congressional district lines in the event that the legislature or governor fail to come up with a successful plan. In the event the legislature is not successful, as we were 2 years ago, in developing the plan signed by the governor, there's no other recourse but to go to court, as has happened in most cases in Oregon history, recent history, including 1991 and 2001, to have the new lines resolved through litigation. Oregon law does not spell out any procedures, though, for how that litigation should be instituted, who brings a claim, where it should be brought, timelines for resolving it. And that vacuum in the statute has led to some uncertainty, to venue shopping, and to a little bit of gamesmanship in the redistricting process. Fortunately, we avoided that largely 2 years ago, but in anticipation of future redistricting in 8 years, in the event the legislature were not to succeed in coming up with a plan, we thought it made sense to try and fill that void now. So I asked representatives of the Democratic and Republican parties to come together to help work out a resolution process that both parties would find fair, neutral, and acceptable. Mr. DiLorenzo, representing the Republican Party, and Roy Pulvers, representing the Democratic Party, worked with representatives of the Judicial Department, including Judge Hazelton, to develop a detailed process for instituting and resolving this litigation, the centerpiece of which is a five-judge panel featuring one judge from each of Oregon's congressional districts to guarantee a fair and level playing field for resolution of what can be a very contentious set of issues. So with that, I'd like to conclude and happy to take any questions.
Great. Do we have any questions for Representative Garrett? Yes, Senator Farriola.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The SMS says, Madam Chair, that the bill before us would increase fairness in the geographic distribution of judges. And that's a topic that interests me. I wonder if the chief proponent could explain how the bill would increase the geographic distribution of judges, increase the fairness of the distribution of judges.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would have worded exactly that way. This isn't really a bill about geographic distribution of judges, except in the sense that rather than have redistricting cases resolved by a single judge who might be from Multnomah County or might be from Yamhill County or might be from Grant County, with both parties seeing potential pros and cons based on the potential viewpoints and dispositions of those different judges, this bill sets out what it does is ensure some geographic balance in the panel that will decide the case by having one judge from each of our congressional districts.
Madam Chair, I think that I think that Representative Garrett is correct. The SMS probably should just say it increases the fairness of the deciding of the question by making sure that the judges come from a wider geographic distribution.
Correct.
And just to clarify, Senator Farriola, the staff major summary that I'm working off of is the one that's been prepared by our committee administrator, and I think it's certainly a valid question, but you're looking at the staff measure summary that preceded it.
So from the House Committee on
Rules.
I guess the implication is that it would be an inferior committee.
I'll just throw that away.
We'll take the heat for it, Senator.
Yeah, we don't want to go there.
I'll just toss that one.
I'm sorry to have wasted the committee's time.
Hopefully you don't have any bills still pending.
Yeah. I'm sure my bills are dead on arrival. No worries there.
Okay, any other questions for Representative Garrett? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very
for
much.
For kicking this off. And we will, so we do have, 3:15 telephone appointment. So I think what we're going to do is recess our hearing on House Bill 2887 and open a public hearing and possible work session on SJR 34. And Lori, would you tell us what this is?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Joint Resolution 34 allows a judge of any court of the state to be employed by the Oregon National Guard for purpose of performing military service, by State Board of Education or School Board for purpose of teaching, without violating Section 1, Article 3, separation of powers, or Section 10, Article 2 of the Oregon Constitution, prohibition against holding two lucrative offices at the same time. That was the measure as introduced. However, there is a dash one amendment that we just received this afternoon, which removes the reference to the school board from the measure, and fiscal and revenue have already come forth with statements. There's a no revenue impact statement and then a fiscal impact statement that was issued that you should have as hard copy before you.
And I see that the chief sponsor of the bill is here, and I, Senator Przanski, if you'd like to come forward, and then I believe that we're getting Judge Kirsten Rasmussen on the telephone to join us too. Good afternoon. Is this Judge Rasmussen?
It is.
Hi, this is Senator Dianne Rosenbaum, Chair of the Senate Rules Committee. I've just opened a hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 34. Senator Przanski is at the dais, and he's going to testify, and then we will ask for your testimony. So just bear with us for a moment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, serving parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Thank you very much for taking up SJR 34 and also considering the amendment of the dash ones, which, as the chair stated, would take out the phrase "or a school board" from the measure as it was presented to you. Colleagues, many of you have seen this similar resolution in previous years. All I can tell you is I believe I've been able to track down whoever had their foot on the air hoses at different sessions, and I believe they have removed their foot, and we will be able to move it forward. I appreciate in the previous years that this committee has been willing to allow for judges in this state to actually be able to participate and be paid for their services as a professor slash teacher at a higher ed school. Specifically, what we what Judge Rasmussen will be speaking of is his participation at the University of Oregon Law School. As the committee members probably know, there's three law schools in the state. Two are private, and only one, being the University of Oregon, is public. That school, based on it being a public school of institution, that it has limitations that the other two do not. And under the current scenario, if a judge wants to participate in some type of symposium or class at the University of Oregon Law School, they have to do it on a voluntary basis. And as you can imagine, even those who want to give their services, as Judge Rasmussen has over the years, it does, in fact, weigh to the point of where the school is not able to compensate them at any level for their services. Judge Rasmussen also has brought forward to my attention, I think, another one that we need to be very concerned with. We addressed it in the previous, I think, bill that we had in 2010, and that is basically the service of judges in the military, such as in the National Guard, that they also could be caught up in this quandary of separation of the branches. Madam Chair, if there's any other questions, I'll take those, but you may want to go ahead and take Judge Rasmussen's testimony first.
Great. Thank you, Senator Przanski. Judge Rasmussen, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, may I just thank you for the time and thank you all for allowing me to do this by phone. I just literally got off the bench about 10 minutes ago, and I would like to note, just as a matter of quick personal privilege, that it's a pleasure to serve and to testify here today in front of you, Madam Chair, as I think our roles were reversed about 20 years ago, and there's a certain joy in that for me. I also think I need to indicate for your record that I'm testifying on my own behalf today and not in a capacity representing the Oregon Judicial Department. you have, I hope, and I believe my June 19th letter to you all in support of this resolution. I don't want to belabor the points there. It's my view that this is a needed constitutional fix which will enable more sitting judges to support their communities as members of the National Guard or as teachers in the local classrooms. This is a bill that is crafted along the lines of a fix that was made many, many decades ago to allow teachers and the public schools to serve in the legislature as well. The case of In re Sawyer has left some question mark about the nature of that service and the extent of that service for judges, which I have pointed out, I think, for a number of years, actually may call into question the nature and extent of service among sitting judges in the Oregon National Guard, a question that I think deserves to be answered and would be answered by passage of this and referral of it to the people, provided, of course, that they in turn passed the proposed amendments. The University of Oregon Law School, as you, of course, know better than most, operates now under some pretty significant budget constraints with some drop in enrollment, and among other things, this would allow the University of Oregon Law School to consider using some adjunct professors from the appellate and trial benches in a way that it is not allowed to do so now by offering to have adjuncts teach evening classes and be able to pay them, which at this point in time, the UVO Law School or any university can't pay, and certainly under In re Sawyer cannot pay a sitting judge, and arguably there's this complication with officers or members of the Oregon National Guard who also serve on the bench. This is a pretty straightforward piece of legislation. It's a pretty straightforward fix. It deals with a couple of lingering outstanding questions that would be definitively answered by the legislation, and so I would greatly appreciate your careful consideration of it, and I urge its passage, and I would be delighted to answer any questions that you may have, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we certainly do appreciate hearing from a former colleague. And just to clarify, I never sat on the bench, so our roles were reversed, but only in one direction. So, okay. Members, do we have any questions for either Senator Przanski or our other witness? I don't see any, so it looks like you've answered them all. Thank you very much. And members, I think, did I open a work session on this? I did. So do we have a motion, Senator Ferrioli?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment dated June 19, 2013.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has do we want to leave Judge Rasmussen on the phone? I guess it doesn't matter.
I'm happy to stay on the phone.
Okay, we'll let you listen to this. So Senator Ferrioli has moved adoption of the -1 amendment to Senate Joint Resolution 34. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Senator Ferrioli?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 34 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved SJR 34 as amended by the -1s. With a be adopted recommendation, is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Senator Przanski, would you like to carry this on the floor? Okay, we'll ask Senator Przanski to carry this on the floor. Thank you very much. Judge Rasmussen, we'll let you go and get back to your duties.
Thank you so much, members of the committee, Madam Chair. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And I will close the work session on SJR 34. And let's see, where shall we go next? Okay, so let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2597. And Lori, could you please tell us about this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2597A provides that the Legislative Assembly determines annual salary for offices of state senator or state representative. It removes the connection between the salary of a member of the Legislative Assembly and the salary of a circuit court judge. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and it moved off the House floor with a 46 aye, 13 no, and one absent vote.
Okay, thank you, Laurie, for that explanation. And it looks like we've now been joined by the Chief Justice, so we're very honored to have you here. Seems to be Judicial Day in Senate Rules. So welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm the Chief Justice. Thank you for taking up House Bill 2597. I'm going to let Mr. Campbell talk briefly about where the bill came from and what it looks like now, and then I'll just make a couple of brief comments, if that's all right.
Great.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association to speak in favor of the bill. I wanted to mention on the House side, the bill actually did two things. A part of it was removed. Originally, the bill would have reactivated and reconstituted the Public Officials Compensation Commission. As you know, that was the commission that made recommendations for salaries based on a study that analyzed what appropriate levels might be for a wide range of public officials. That happened in 2008, and then the committee was changed and basically became inactive. And we removed our portion of the bill that reactivated that committee. In time, we believe that that Public Officials Compensation Commission plays an important role, but not today. And so that portion was removed. And what is left in the bill today is a disconnection between judicial and legislative compensation decisions that the legislature makes. It has been connected and disconnected over the years. We believe that they should be independent decisions that the legislature makes between these two vastly different roles. And so with that, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'll turn it back over to the Chief Justice for some additional comments. But I want to thank you for considering the bill today. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Basically, this all that's before you is the disconnect. We, frankly, don't want any legislative reluctance to indirectly increase legislative compensation to adversely affect the consideration of judicial pay. That's it. There's no dollars involved with this. It would have no effect this year, one way or the other, frankly. But there, as you can recognize, there are different considerations in terms of judicial compensation and legislative compensation. There has been a feeling that the linkage may have had an adverse effect on sort of the independent consideration of judicial compensation, and so we think that it ought to be severed. These things ought to be looked at separately as the legislature sees fit. So that's the basic reason for this.
Okay, well, thank you very much for bringing this to us and for your testimony. Do we have any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Senator Starr.
Just thank you very much. So I support the concept in the bill. How will judges' salaries be set?
Judges' salaries are set by the legislature.
That's what I thought.
This current legislation sets legislative pay at the higher of or the lower of?
Higher of.
The higher of 17% of a circuit judge's pay and some identified position within executive compensation. But because we could have a longer discussion, Senator, about whether it's appropriate to have judicial pay set in statute. The default is that it doesn't change, that it hasn't changed in 5 years. But you know, same thing for legislative compensation. It's a struggle. And this is just sort of disconnect the two, and the legislature can act or not act on either one as it deems appropriate.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Farioli.
A statement, Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me. I guess this is a case of impoverishment by association. The legislature has enjoyed a race to the bottom where either chamber or both parties engage in making a show of their dedication to selfless service to the state. We're now in a situation where we're serving annual sessions. There are no interims. We're understaffed, arguably overworked, and I believe that the judges' desire to disassociate themselves from legislators is ample proof that at least one of those groups is undercompensated. But I think it should come as no surprise that the members of the judicial branch would seek to distance themselves from legislatures, at least in the regard of compensation. And I do
Senator
agree.
Perry, only in that regard. We're not trying to disassociate ourselves generally from the legislature.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I think with reasonable demonstration that there has been an adverse effect on judicial salaries. It's just one of those situations. You couldn't raise the judges' salaries without indirectly raising the legislators' salaries, and that is just a political non-starter. So I think you're doing the wise thing by asking that the judges be separated for purposes of establishing compensation. What remains, Madam Chair, is whether or not the legislature will ever be able to compensate members fairly for their services.
Yes, well, certainly that's a question perhaps for another day, but I take your point. Other questions? So I did want to ask, and Kevin, maybe this is a question for you. I totally understand why we're disconnecting from judicial salaries, but why were we also disconnecting from the other provision that tied legislative salaries to an executive branch salary range?
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my belief was to restore it to its prior position before the 2009 session where the two were connected. I don't know the complete history years before that, because I think there's other occasions where this has been connected and disconnected, but I think it was designed to restore it to where it was prior to 2009.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2597 and open a work session on House Bill 2597. Senator Farioli?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2597 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 2597 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, motion carries. And Senator Farioli, you've spoken so eloquently on this. Would you like to carry it on the floor?
I would love to carry this bill.
Great. So we'll have Senator Farioli carry this on the floor, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2597. And I think we should have Representative Krieger, having waited so patiently, probably should go there. So I'll next open a public hearing on House Bill 3441B because Representative Krieger has been waiting very patiently, and I'll ask him to come forward. And it looks like we've morphed into a new committee administrator, and so welcome Beth Riley to the Senate Rules Committee. Would you like to just tell us what this bill is?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House Bill 3441B establishes the 15-member Orphan Hatchery Research Center Advisory Committee, appointed by the Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and it names the Hatchery Research Center located on Fall Creek near Elsie as the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, and requires the center to carry out certain duties. Declares an emergency is effective upon passage, and you have a B-10 amendment in your packet, which has a no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact, which requires that on or before February 1st of each year, the committee would report on research findings and recommendations regarding hatchery management to the legislature, the ODF&W director, and the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and it has requirements for them to post material on their public website.
Thank you, Beth, for that explanation, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. I'm going to just take a couple minutes of history of this thing so you kind of get the flavor. I'm not going to go into some of the detail, but the bill went through a process starting probably sometime in September up until the time we got here and started session. A long process of development. There were 19 specific word changes in different parts of the bill. They were done to accommodate the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, organizations that supported the bill, and I'll give you a list of those. Myself and Senator Roblin, after talking over what would be the best policy to take care of the research hatchery and make sure it did the work that it needed to do. Salmon for All, Oregon State University, and Legislative Council has some suggestions. We accommodated those because it made it a better bill. The bill has been supported by the LC Sportsman Association, Association of Northwest Steelheaders, Carpenters International Union, Mackenzie River Guides Association, the Native Fish Society, Oregon Anglers, Oregon Chapter of Coastal Conservation Association, Oregon Chapter of Trout Unlimited, Oregon Aggregate Producers, Oregon Coastal Ports Association, Oregon Farm Bureau, Oregon Outdoor Council, Oregon Salmon Commission, Oregonians for Food and Salmon for All, Seafood Oregon, Small Woodland Owners Association. In the time that I've been here, I have never seen a bill that dealt with natural resources that had this support in its original form as this bill. The original bill passed out of the House 58-0. No one testified against it. Representative Witt and Bailey both spoke eloquently in favor of it, recognizing it and having discussed the issue. They understood what we're trying to do. The Senate version, which is 341, I guess the being engrossed, is not acceptable. It does not provide the proper oversight or accountability of the Department of Fish and Wildlife and Oregon State University. I won't go into the details of what's been going on over the last 8 years, but the research that really was specific, I made the comment in the hearings in both the Senate and in the House, you could put on a postage stamp using large print, and it costed $18 million to get it. The best bill would be the original version with the Dash 10s, and specific to the Dash 10s, because that's what you're talking about, they are really not bad. You know, if they were amended into the original bill, that'd be fine. Let me give you an example of sometimes when people write things, maybe they aren't as familiar with the issues they think they are. If you go to your Dash 10s and look at lines 16, conduct research to implement and advance the Oregon plan as defined in ORS 541-890. The Oregon plan cannot drive research results. Predetermined outcome is not science. We may find, if the right science is worked over there and done, that there needs to be adjustments to the Oregon plan, not to adapt science to the plan. So that's in there. It's kind of strange the way it's written, but I would hope that the Dash 10s don't hurt the original bill, but I do not support the being engrossed version.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And do we have any questions? Senator Starr.
So I just want to be clear. Do you want to have the Dash, you support adopting the Dash 10s to the bill and moving the bill, or no?
I'd rather have that than nothing. However, the Dash 7, which went into the original bill, really ruined the bill and caused a lack of accountability and lack of oversight. And the Department of Fish and Wildlife came over here and got that job done, and they were bragging about getting it done. I don't much appreciate that.
Sure.
Yes, go ahead.
So you'd prefer that a engrossed version of the bill?
Most certainly would, and of those groups that I read off, I only know one that might support the B version, only to get it to the floor and possibly a conference committee. That's the way people are thinking. But the proper policy, the proper oversight, and the focus should be on making our salmon a research center do the research that it does to minimize the impact of hatchery fish on wild fish and protect our wild fish population the best that we can. And we're not doing that now.
So, and just also to clarify, so I'm not really sure what would happen since if we adopted the B-10 amendment into the original bill, since the B-10 was drafted off of the B-engrossed version of the bill, I assume this would all have to go back to Legislative Council to get sort. I mean, I totally understand that you're saying you would prefer the bill as it passed the House, but
yeah, well,
it came to
us
as the B-engrossed.
Drafted possibly for a conference committee, but I don't want to say anything here that impugns people's motives. Things happened with this bill, Senator, that should not have happened. There was an opportunity. Representative Senator Roblin had talked to the President of the Senate about the need for the bill and what committee it should be in. That didn't happen.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Krieger? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Trying to get clear here. So your preference would be, given what's in front of us, adopt the dash 10s and pass the bill with those in it?
I'd rather have that than nothing at this time, yes. But I think I want you also to realize the original bill, with the support it had, not only from 58, every Democrat, every Republican on the floor that day, and the entire constituent base, who, if you look at some of them, they're always fighting. Salmon for All, you know, and CCA, the Gillnet issue, they're on the same page.
Okay, and we do have other people signed up to testify on this bill, so maybe it'll become clearer as we hear more testimony. Okay. I don't see any other questions, so thank you very much waiting so patiently. And I guess since we are on this bill, and I don't see, is that okay? I don't see any other legislators in the room at
there's
the moment. So,
a couple right there.
Oh, I do. Oh, Representative Gelster is back. So I hate to do this, folks, but I think I will recess the hearing on House Bill 3441, ask our regular committee administrator to come back and open a public hearing on House Bill 2672B. And Lori, could you tell us what this is?
Be happy to, Madam Chair. House Bill 2672B establishes workplace protections for domestic workers, clarifies that the definition of domestic worker includes individual who is not compensated by state agency for work performed, excludes from the definition employees employed by licensed home health agency or in-home care agency. It designates violation unlawful employment practice. It directs Bureau of Labor and Industries to adopt rules related to domestic workers. There is a B9 amendment and hand-engrossed hard copy for you, and that B9 excludes from the definition of domestic worker a worker compensated with public funds for work performed, excludes independent contractor and certain individuals performing companionship services from that definition. It requires the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to adopt rules for calculation of overtime work during travel and medical emergency. It removes the provision making day of worship coincidental to time of domestic worker rest. It revises a provision specifying conditions for rest of domestic work living in the home of an employer. It removes the requirement to provide record of hours worked to BOLI upon request. And it removes a provision specifying that BOLI adopt rules pertaining to the weekly overtime of domestic worker. There's no revenue impact on the dash B9, but we do not yet have a fiscal statement, though I will check right now.
Okay, thank you, Lori, and welcome Representatives Gelser and Vega Peterson. Please welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, and please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for your indulgence. We are both next door at Revenue, where we have temporarily recessed awaiting a fiscal. as you know, that's the way it goes.
It's a common problem.
This time of session. So if Representative Barnhart comes flying in, you will know why. House Bill 2672 has had a number of public hearings so far, and I'm going to give you the abbreviated version kind of as a courtesy to time and the people that are waiting here. But House Bill 2672 is about expanding basic workplace protections to domestic workers, primarily nannies and housekeepers. This bill really has been crafted very narrowly. It does not include those caregivers for elderly, for ill adults, or for the disabled, and I'll explain why in a moment. When you look at the protections that are available under current law for these workers, they are missing some that are very important. Most importantly, they are not required to have a contract when they work. This bill will allow them to know when they start working what their expected hours of work are and what their regular payday is and what their conditions of work are, just like you would when you go to any other position. This bill will help to clarify for the employer and the employee what the overtime protections are. Unfortunately, there are many people that hire nannies and housekeepers right now that don't recognize that nannies that do not live in your home actually are eligible for overtime right now and should be being paid overtime right now. Those who are not paying overtime to their live-out nannies are not currently in compliance with the law. This is going to help bring some attention to that issue and help people be more compliant. The bill also, very importantly, makes sure that those domestic workers that live in the home, so a housekeeper that lives with you or a nanny that lives with with you, has access in a 24-hour period to 8 hours of rest. During that 8 hours of rest, she could take a shower, she could sleep, and we want to make sure that she has access to adequate a place that has adequate conditions for sleeping. And there's an amendment that addresses this, which I'll come back to in a minute. The bill also ensures that a passport cannot be taken from the worker as a condition of employment, and it extends basic workplace protections around discrimination and sexual harassment to these workers. Right now, they are excluded from all of those protections. When we brought this bill out of the Oregon House and into the other committee, one of the concerns, we heard a couple of concerns that are addressed in the Dash 9 amendment. One of the questions was, if this bill does not cover independent contractors, why not just have it say that in the bill? And so the B9 amendment does add independent contractors as an entity that's excluded from the bill. So if you have someone that you've hired as your housekeeper that comes in twice a month for a couple of hours and they have their own business, they are not covered by this bill. They are covered if they are your employee, but absolutely not if they are an independent contractor. The amendment also clarifies that individuals who are performing companionship services that are exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act are also not included in this bill. That is just really cleanly clarifying that it's not including elder and disabled care. We have clarified on line 26 of the B engrossed bill that written contract at the beginning will be required to include expected hours of work, the rate of regular and overtime pay, and regular paydays. We will leave it up to the employer and the employee to decide whether that contract would include sick leave, vacation leave, personal leave, and holiday description. That would no longer be required. In the House and again in the Senate, there were a lot of questions of what happens if you have a nanny and you go on a vacation with that nanny. Do I have to pay the nanny for the time we're on the airplane? If we're at Disneyland, do I have to pay the nanny for the time that we are watching the fireworks? The answer to that is that Boley has addressed many of these issues through rule. When I worked for DHS, if I traveled to Southern Oregon, I was still paid. I was reimbursed for my meals and for my mileage when I did that drive, but I was not reimbursed for that time that I was sleeping and that I was off duty. This bill adds some language that clarifies that this issue is addressed in rule. We also, if you look down to lines 4 and 5, we created some more flexibility around the day off each week, the 24 consecutive hours of work each week. It had indicated that that would coincide with the employee's day of worship. The amendment removes that provision. In lines 8 and 9, we have replaced that with language, again, that uses the word rest instead of the word sleep. There were those that were concerned they might be held accountable if their worker chose not to sleep during their hours of rest. But what this actually says is, in a 24-hour period, a 16-hour working day is long enough. You would have 8 consecutive hours of rest in that 24-hour period. We removed the language about providing accurate records of daily and weekly hours to Boley. And we removed rulemaking requests in lines 39 to 41 about rules about overtime. Again, there are some rules about that already, and we've addressed that issue up above. And finally, we again swapped out the word rest for the word sleep to avoid that confusion. In the end, colleagues, this is a good bill, and I'm very grateful to those in the Senate that have helped come up with these amendments to make it something that more people will be able to support. And I believe that in this form, it will also pick up some additional votes when it comes back to the House for concurrence. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. And I believe you have testimony in the record from Family Forward Oregon as well.
I believe we do, yes. And I think we'll hear from Representative Vega Peterson, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I represent House District 47, which is the part of East Portland that's east of I-205. So Representative Gelser did an amazing job. I'm going into the detailed bill, and I know that you have a lot of things on the agenda today, so I'll just be brief. The protections in this bill are very modest, and they do have a lot of clarity. A lot of work's been going into making them clear for people who are employees of domestic workers. But the protections that it provides are things that most Americans take for granted every day. I wanted to just point out that 90% of domestic workers are women, and the vast majority of them are women of color. The fact that this type of worker has been explicitly excluded from other state and federal labor statutes is a reflection of the lack of value that we'd placed on this kind of work and on the women that do that. And that's changed now that there's a growing recognition that this is important work. It allows families the peace of mind and security to know that their children are being taken care of when they're working outside the home. This is something that the time has come to pass this kind of legislation. I'm pleased that we have the opportunity to do that here in Oregon to make sure that our laws can reflect the respect that we have for this type of work and the value that we place on the almost 10,000 workers in Oregon that do this kind of work. And so I urge your passage of this bill.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Did we have any questions for the representatives? Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you. So, on the first page of the bill, in lines 21 on, does that talk about a contract that the employer has to have with the worker? Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I don't know that it says it needs to be a contract. It needs to be a written notice. So I'm not an attorney, so I don't know what the difference is between a written notice and a contract, but it doesn't say a contract. Right now, there is, what we've heard from some nannies is there might be a verbal agreement about what the rate of pay is, what days she's supposed to work. That can create confusion and conflict. And so this would be a written statement.
So a question, Chair.
Yes,
so,
follow-up.
I'm assuming that in some cases these domestic workers, live-in nannies, whatnot, do have written contracts with the employer. Would a written contract or contract, could a domestic worker sign a contract that is in some way in conflict with the statute, and that a contract be valid above, beyond what the statute says? Or does the statute override any kind of written agreement between an employee and an employer?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, this would create minimum, kind of those base minimum standards that an employee could expect.
You didn't answer the question, Madam Chair. If I wanted to go to work for somebody as a nanny, and instead of agreeing to having 8 hours of rest, I said in my contract that I agreed to that I would work for 18 hours rather than 16 and only need 6 hours of rest. Could I write that contract and not be in conflict with the statute? Or does the statute preclude me from writing a contract and agreeing to it, knowing full well what the terms of the contract were ahead of time?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I'm going to try to answer your question the best way that I can. What the bill would allow is for an individual could end up working more than the hours that are listed in this bill. It may trigger overtime provisions for that individual. This is one of the reasons why, for instance, we talked about travel and medical emergencies, just like in nannying and housekeeping and in other work environments. There are times when the normal work day changes, but they would be, if they exceeded that 40 hours, they would be moving into overtime protections.
Madam Chair, just to follow on. Again, so I eyes wide open. I'm a nanny looking for a job. I'm agreeing to, I don't know what the right number is, $2,500 a month flat fee to serve as a nanny. Line out the details of the contract. You know, how many hours I expect to work, what the conditions are. You know, all of those things in a contract. What you're saying is the words in the statute would preclude me from negotiating a contract that were outside of the bounds of the statute, and I would have to, I wouldn't have the freedom to negotiate my own contract, I guess. Is that correct?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I guess there's two answers to that question. The first, in terms of negotiating rate of pay and how that compares to overtime, for a nanny, for a live-out nanny, under federal law right now, she is entitled to at least minimum wage and overtime. So federal law would preclude her from negotiating a contract that didn't meet those basic standards. I think the second issue is, for a lot of these individuals that are negotiating, the law is necessary necessary to create some of these minimum standards because they're very, very vulnerable when they are when they're negotiating the contracts. And I think especially around the original question around whether a person would want to enter into a contract that didn't allow her to sleep every day, I think it would be reasonable that we have law that protects an individual, that it's not something that they have to negotiate for to get that right to have access to sleep and rest in a on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So,
did you want to clarify your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I break in here?
Please.
I can't stand anymore because I'm a former judiciary chair. The purpose of the law is to set the parameters for the contract. So you could negotiate a contract that was more employee-friendly, but you could not negotiate standards that were less than in the law. Mm-hmm. That's the answer to your question.
Thank
Pardon
you.
Me for breaking in.
Much appreciated. And much more articulate. Thank you.
No, it wasn't that.
So, other questions? Okay. And I did, I guess I'll ask you one.
Okay.
So, in the B9 amendment, I know you've hand engrossed the bill for us, but I did want to ask you about the provision in the B9 that is lines 10 through 13 that basically calls for rulemaking dealing with overtime for domestic workers during periods of travel and medical emergencies. Mm-hmm. And I think on your hand engrossed bill, that would be what you've described as insert B on page 2.
Correct.
So I wanted to just clarify what your intention was in directing rules to be written dealing with overtime during periods of travel and medical emergencies.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Starr. This question came up a number of times. Already, individuals who are protected by wage and hour law are protected by overtime provisions, and there is rule within BOLI that applies to these unusual kinds of circumstances. This would not authorize BOLI to adopt a special set of overtime provisions for a special set of workers. They would still have to be within the bounds of federal law.
So these rules that would need to be consistent with existing rules.
Yes, they would need to be they would need to be consistent with existing rules that have existed prior to the passage of this legislation. And I think that one of the reasons this is very important in the discussions about this and with others who have had nannies, it's very clear that there is a significant amount of confusion about how current law already applies. And having this discussion in rule, which is a reapplication with an existing law, I think will be very helpful.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. Any other questions?
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator Farioli?
Going back to the SMS, the it looks like the effect on BOLI after rules are adopted is indeterminate, and there's no fiscal analysis of what this might cost. And I just wondered if we could have some discussion about that.
I think, Senator Farioli, we haven't yet received the fiscal on the amendment.
In progress. So
it's in the works.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Did you have another question? Or?
So, again, I apologize, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Again, reading the SMS of the effect of the committee amendment, it said excludes independent contractor and certain individuals performing companionship services. So, an independent contractor would, what is that, who is that person, I guess?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Starr. The independent contractor would be a person who controls their own schedule, their own method of completing the work. This is going to apply primarily to the housekeepers. You really cannot be a nanny and be an independent contractor because you aren't setting your own hours and you aren't setting your own standards for the way that you provide that work. By definition, a nanny cannot be an independent contractor.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, now I think you've answered all of our questions, and I
thank
think
you.
We know where to find you if we think of any more. So thank you both for your testimony, and we'll hope that your paperwork arrives next door. Okay, and I don't have anybody else signed up to testify on this bill, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2672B. Members, we do not have paperwork for this, and I think we'll go back and try to tie up some loose ends where we left off.
Do you have a
We have just one witness on redistricting, right? So how about if we go back to we recessed on House Bill 2887. We were in the middle of taking testimony, and we only have one more witness, so we'll call John DiLorenzo. Thank you for waiting so patiently. You're getting to see several branches of government at work. So
you're welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here in your committee and witness you hard at work. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I am a lawyer from Portland, but I am testifying here today on my own behalf, not on behalf of any client, in support of House Bill 2887A. I would like to correct the record a bit. During the negotiations that Representative Garrett referenced, I did not represent the Republican Party as a client, but I certainly brought the perspective of several decades of representation of them in redistricting litigation to the table. Several months ago, Representative Garrett asked that I and others who had experience in the redistricting process come together and address a need which arises once each decade. 22 years ago, I had the pleasure to represent plaintiffs in federal court in the 1991 congressional redistricting litigation, which resulted in a judicially approved plan. 12 years ago, I had the pleasure to represent Senator Atkinson. I said here, Beyer, that's Roger Beyer, and others. I think Senator Starr may have been involved in that litigation. In Perrin versus Kitzhaber, the 2001 congressional redistricting litigation. Current federal judge Michael Simon, who at the time was a partner in the Perkins Coie firm, represented the plaintiff, and Thane Tenson represented then Senators Kate Brown and Dan Gardner. That litigation involved a hearing before a three-judge federal panel and then a two-week trial in the Multnomah County Circuit Court. Thereafter, certain aspects of the case were appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals, ultimately finding their way to the Oregon Supreme Court. Your historic agreement in 2011 deprived the lawyers of another good case. However, before you came to a resolution, there was still an attempt to be the first to the courthouse, evidenced by a filing in the Yamhill County Circuit Court. That filing was made at the time because under the Groh versus Emerson decision of the United States Supreme Court, the federal courts will abstain from hearing federal redistricting litigation unless it is apparent that the state processes are incapable of producing well-apportioned districts by the next scheduled election. Any Oregon Circuit Court has proper venue to hear such a case, thus the race to the courthouse. In 2001, the Democrats filed first in Multnomah County Circuit Court, well before the legislative session had adjourned. Similarly, in 2011, the Republicans filed first in the Yamhill County Circuit Court. The race to the courthouse raised concerns which may well have had more to do with perception than reality, but Representative Garrett, who co-chaired the House Redistricting Committee last session, asked a number of us to address it and to work with him to remedy that situation. We ultimately fashioned a proposal which would first eliminate the race to the courthouse, second, ensure geographic diversity with respect to the judicial decision makers, third, increase public perception of fairness, and fourth, eliminate the need for multiple filings and consolidation of cases, which might span a variety of county circuit courts. Judge Hazelton of the Court of Appeals, Roy Pulvers, Bruce Miller of the Oregon Judicial Department, Dan Gilbert, and representatives of the Secretary of State's office and I participated in the work group and designed a product which I believe will address those concerns. House Bill 2778A creates a process for handling federal redistricting litigation, but does not make any substantive changes to the criteria which apply to redistricting plans. Nor does the bill alter the causes of action which a party must first allege in order to seek a reapportionment of a congressional district. Those causes of action are likely to remain the Federal Civil Rights Act and the Declaratory Judgments Act. What the bill does is first create a centralized venue, that being Marion County, and a process for filing and adjudicating petitions which challenge a congressional reapportionment or a lack of one. If a petition is filed, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court appoints a special judicial panel. The panel consists of one circuit court judge, senior judge, or judge who is serving as a pro tem judge from each congressional district of the state. The Chief Justice also selects one of the appointed judges to preside over the special panel to make all rulings on procedure and evidentiary matters before the panel. The panel may also request the Chief Justice appoint a special master to receive evidence and to prepare recommended findings of fact. If the legislature adopts a congressional reapportionment plan, the panel must affirm the plan if it complies with all applicable statutes and the United States and the Oregon constitutions. If no legislatively adopted congressional plan is enacted, then the panel must consider all plans submitted by petitioners and interveners and can create its own reapportionment plan, which must apply with all applicable statutes, the U.S. Constitution, and the state constitution. The bill addresses appeals, how those work, and addresses other procedural issues. Madam Chair, I would like to thank Representative Garrett for having provided me the opportunity to serve on this work group, and also members of the work group who developed this consensus product. The bill received the unanimous endorsement of the House Rules Committee and passed the House by a vote of 57-0. I ask that you also give it your favorable consideration and recommend it to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your time. I am available to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Thank you for your work on this, and thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions for this witness, Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DiLorenzo, in the selection of the Chief Justice, well, the designation of the Chief Justice to be the decider to select circuit court senior judges or pro tem judges from each of the five congressional districts. Why did you not select the judges from the five congressional districts by lot rather than allowing the Chief Justice to be the one person who can influence the outcome of the proceedings by selecting the justices that may in fact reflect a particular political persuasion or predilection? In other words, why not a completely impartial random selection rather than making one individual not only the controller of who the deciders are, but who the special master might be?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Farioli, the thinking of the group was that the Chief Justice was best equipped to determine who within each congressional district could handle the case from the perspective of competence, knowledge of the law, and time availability. We could not think of anyone better than the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court to do that. I think we all come at this, even those of us who have represented partisan clients, with the assumption that the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court is going to place partisanship aside, especially when he or she is selecting judges who will be adjudicators for a process as important as this. I think it would be certainly in the best interest of the court that the court never allow a partisan consideration to determine which judges would be the ones who were chosen to hear the case. Of course, you are decision makers too. This is a consensus product. It is our recommendation, and certainly you have the opportunity to interject other means to determine the panel. I personally do not favor appointment by lot. I do not like the idea of rolling the dice with respect to appointment of a panel to consider matters as lofty as these. I do think having a decision maker who knows the court and who's able to evaluate the resources that he or she has before them is the proper person to decide these things.
Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up.
Madam Chair, Justice Caesar's wife is above suspicion. I would never suggest that any Chief Justice would bring political experience or biases to the selection of the panel. However, we do select our ballot analysts who write the ballot measure explanations by lot, because what we want is impartial selection of folks that will represent different viewpoints without bias. So I understand that you don't think the lottery selection of justices from each of the five congressional districts might not be as good as the Chief Justice's discrimination in this case, but I would suggest to you, if we're worried about court shopping or justice shopping or shopping of venues, why do we assume the Chief Justice's just because of the importance of the decision are any more beyond bias than, say, members of this panel would be?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I appreciate your viewpoint. I support the decisions that were made by the work group for the reasons I have already stated. I understand there are other ways of addressing this. I would submit that the mechanism that is represented in House Bill 2887 is a major improvement over the current system. And to the extent that you might be able to think of ways to make it better, you certainly would have my support in that undertaking.
Perhaps, okay. Madam Chair, I'm simply reminiscing about our success in redistricting not only our state districts but the congressional districts. Mm-hmm. First time in 100 years. For the congressional redistricting.
That was a major, major achievement, and one which surprised and delighted many people.
And who knows, lightning might strike twice, and this may never come to pass, but certainly
well, Madam Chair,
provides for a process. So.
Judges take an oath, which for a while did not include the term with impartiality. We had to reinstall the term impartiality, and I think we're taking it on faith that Chief Justices have and always will be impartial in their selections. I don't necessarily believe it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator Ferrioli. Senator Starr, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm reading the statute and reading your testimony, one of the things that I didn't realize until you brought it to my attention in your testimony on page 4, that this panel will convene regardless of whether the legislature adopts the plan or not, because the panel has to confirm that the legislatively adopted plan is consistent with the Constitution's. That is a little bit of a surprise to me. It seems to me that the only need that would arise for that is if there was a court challenge to the legislatively adopted plan, as opposed to an automatic referral to the panel, regardless of a court challenge. Or am I reading that correctly or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I think I believe the bill provides that if the legislature enacts a reapportionment of a congressional district, and if there is a case brought a challenge, then the panel convenes. The panel does not convene automatically,
right,
to just bless the reapportionment. Is my understanding.
So, but if I'm Madam Chair,
and can you just, if you're looking at lines, tell us where you are.
So I was checking to see what page it is. Page 2 of the bill, mm-hmm, lines 27. Well, the section 8 starts in 25, but it says, and starting line 27, for a legislatively adopted reapportionment plan, the panel must affirm the plan if the plan complies with applicable statutes and the constitutions.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I would call your attention to line 9, on the same page. Subsection 6 of that section, mm-hmm, says, if an elector files a petition under subsection 2 of this section, the Chief Justice shall appoint the special judicial panel. What triggers the appointment of the panel is the filing of a petition by a registered voter. Once the panel is appointed, then the rest of the text talks about what the panel does, and a lot of what it does is based upon whether the legislature actually came up with a plan or not. But what triggers the appointment of the panel is the filing of a challenge.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for that clarification. And so do we have any other questions? I do not see any for you. So thank you again for
your
testimony. And we are, looks like we're missing members. Are we?
I'm good.
Yeah. Okay. Did I open a work session on this bill? I can't remember. Well, in case I didn't, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2887. And Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2887 to the floor with a due process recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2887 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Senator Farrioli. Mike, could you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Excused.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farrioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And bill moves to the floor. And I know that we had two members of this committee that did serve on the redistricting committee. And Senator Starr, I believe you were one and Senator Beyer was the other. So how about if we sign the two of you to carry this?
I would prefer to have the other...
Other senator carry?
Other senator carry, okay. Since one of my colleagues is...
Okay, great. Motion. So we'll ask Senator Beyer if he's willing to carry this on the floor, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2887 and go back to... yes, we had recessed House Bill 3441, so I'll reopen the hearing on House Bill 3441B. And thank our witnesses for waiting so patiently. And welcome back to the podium. And I'll call Tom Wolf, Dennis.
He left.
Okay, great. How about Jim Myron? And Joe Rolliter's here. And how about Dennis Ritchie? How about if the three of you come forward, and we will have Mr. Wolf join us when he comes back. And once again, welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, and thank you for waiting so patiently. It's a hectic time in session.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rolliter. I'm here today testifying on my own behalf. I acted as the scribe or the writer, the drafter of this particular piece of legislation. And sometime in September, when a number of us decided, September of last year, when a number of us were concerned about the statutory authority and the operation of the Oregon-Hatchery Research Center, I began calling other folks, and I invited about 60 people, and they're mostly lobbyists from this building, and 20 of them showed up, and we worked through the issues, and we had three different legislative drafts. We had three amendments after the second legislative draft was introduced as a priority bill. And we all came to an agreement, and it passed as the A version of the bill, and it came here to the Senate, and then in the Senate committee, the process worked in a particular way. I would have to say that we all have so much invested in this process that we would like to see the bill move forward. If I had my druthers, I would like to have seen the dash or the A version of the bill move forward. I think that's the version that's had the most open discussion. It's the version that people like Jim Myron, Dennis Ritchie, myself agreed on the language. But I would really like to see this bill move forward, and if that means adopting the dash 10 amendment into the B version of the bill, I would prefer that to having you kill the bill. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for testimony. I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from all three of you. So please go ahead.
My name is Dennis Ritchie. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Anglers. Our office is located in West Lynn, but we represent individual fishing clubs and fishermen from Astoria to Gold Beach and mostly in Western Oregon. We're also an all-volunteer group. I have been a member of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center's Advisory Committee since it was founded. The first year I served as vice chair, the next 2 years I served as chair, and I have been I'm still a member of that committee and have been very actively engaged in its mission. I believe strongly in the mission, and I believe that mission is very good for the economy of Oregon. However, I think we have stalled somewhat. We've done a lot of wonderful research. We have one of the best leading scientists in the world. And we have a wonderful, wonderful research center. But when it comes to answering the big questions, we're not making much progress. When I was approached, I agreed that something needed to be shaken up a little bit. And I've been involved in this process, trying to make sure that probably the least amount of harm be done and that we make some positive progress. The A version would have done that. Other people did not agree on some of it. The B version is sincerely watered down and takes most of the influence that this stakeholder committee would have out and puts it back kind of behind the curtains where the science committee is making the decisions, and we're not seeing projects come before us one way or another. Some of those projects were suggested by committee members, and they've never seen the light of day. Probably the major thing is that we are very close to making hatchery mitigation, legitimate again. Most of the anti-hatchery most of the rhetoric you see in the newspaper and here is they don't talk about how close. They say the hatchery fish are inferior to the wild fish.
Mm-hmm.
However, that's based on the Hood River Project, and the scientists came before us and presented all their findings very early, the geneticists, and a wild cross was about 85% successful. A hatchery cross was about 72% successful. However, a cross between a hatchery fish and a wild fish was in the low 80s. Statistically the same as a wild. Now, we have moved in the hatcheries to using brood stock, wild brood stock, mixed in with the hatchery stock, and we've gotten even closer now. We need to scientifically get involved in this. We need to prove that we can come closer and not do damage to the wild stock. The tribes are doing it. I went to a tribal conference, and this last fall, they had 16 brochures on projects that they successfully used hatchery mitigation to bring back the wild fish in various creeks and rivers in the West. I would just like to see this move forward. The B version is weaker. Maybe it's an improvement. The A version would have been something we could have lived with a little easier. Being on the board, I would have felt that it was more meaningful, but I'd rather not see the bill die.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. During this several months long discussion over this bill, Native Fish Society's primary goal has been to get some statutory direction to the Oregon Hatchery Research Council in place. When the research center was first conceived and authorized by the legislature in 2001, it was done with a budget appropriation and a budget note. There was never any legislation passed describing the duties or the functions or any of that. So we felt it's time to do that. The A version of the bill did that, as does the B version in front of you today. So we're fine with the B version, and the Dash 10 amendments provide some clarity to the bill that came out of the Senate committee. So we support the B version of the bill along with the Dash 10 amendments. Thank you.
Okay, questions for these folks?
Question.
Go ahead, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Myron, for you, the engross version, do you support it at a higher level than you support the B version of the bill?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, the Native Fish Society supported the A version that came out of the House. At this point, I would say that we haven't decided that there's any preference, but the bill before you is the B one, so that's what our testimony is based on.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Additional questions? Yes, Senator Farioli.
You mentioned one of the witnesses mentioned tribal success with the strategy of wild hatchery crosses. Who were the tribal members, and which tribes were represented on the working group?
On the advisory committee?
Yes. Please.
Right now, the current chair is a scientist from the Siletz tribe.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Okay.
And he's been on the committee for a number of years.
I'm sure, follow up.
Sure, go ahead.
Did the tribes take a position on the engrossed version of the bill?
I'm not aware that the tribes that got involved at all.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, if I may. No, the tribes did not engage. I invited the lobbyist members and the folks that I know personally from the three coastal tribes, as well as the executive director of the Columbia River Fish Commission, Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and none of them chose to come into this legislature and spend the time to work through this. I have no idea why or why not.
I guess it's just a logistic question. The Legislative Commission on Indian Services is here in the building, and I wonder if anybody contacted LCIS to see if there was to extend an invitation for formal consultation on this issue.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, no, we did not. However, the bill does stipulate that the tribal member of whatever is appointed, both versions, the A version and the B version, what the membership makeup is appointed by the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife after consultation with the Indian Services Commission.
Madam Chair, it just seems to me that the issue is so important that and the divergence of thinking on the management of hatcheries is absolutely central to the relationship between non-Indian and Indian managers of tribal fisheries. So it's a little mystifying that the consultation wasn't undertaken prior to the framing of this of the bill itself, and I'd certainly think it's not too late to ask for some sort of weigh-in on the A engrossed House Bill 3441 versus the B engrossed, and to get and to solicit an opinion on the Dash B10s. It would seem imprudent not to do at least that.
And I don't think that really requires an answer from these good folks that Bill isn't in a position to move today anyway, so we certainly would be able to reach out and get additional testimony on it. So, but I did, and we'll call our next witness, but I did want to ask you one question. So my understanding is that there is an existing committee that is already charged with doing some of what this bill is requiring. And could you just explain to me, because I wasn't on the policy committee and didn't have the benefit of the original discussions, what is it that this bill achieves that isn't able to be done by that committee now?
Chair Rosenbaum, the current makeup includes a number of at-large positions, citizens at large, scientists at large. I took the roster this morning and looked at the roster and saw how many of those people would fit in to this. Actually, two people would lose their positions that are at large and don't fit the niches, and we would need one person then. And I think that was a port representative, but
it's essentially the makeup of this newly constituted commission that would be different, or
Chair Rosenbaum? Actually, it's not just the makeup; it's a matter of this committee looking more at all the possibilities and having a little more say. In other words, we feel like we're a rubber stamp right now, committee, and we get reports, but we really don't make any decisions.
If I could respond to your question, Chair Rosenbaum. For the Native Fish Society, I believe it was Section 5 of the A engrossed version, and it's now Section 3 and the B engrossed version, are the critical components of the bill to us, because it provides direction to the center on the kinds of research that they could do that would be most helpful for future fish management decisions by the state of Oregon. So it's not the makeup of the group, but what they're charged with doing. And by putting it into statute makes it clear what their mission is. Right now, they don't have that same statutory mission.
Okay, thank you for that answer.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you all for your testimony. We have one other person. I think he is here, and that's Tom Wolf, if you'd like to come forward, and we'll take your testimony.
Chair Rosenbaum, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm going to keep my testimony very brief. I've got to run back to Hillsboro for a meeting concerning the possibility of starting a new park at the Orenco Woods Park. So you have my comments before you. We, Trout Unlimited, has supported this concept of 3441, HB 3441, since it started. We have been involved with all the groups that were set up here before. We currently support HB 3441B-10 amendments also. We feel that whereas it does differ from the A and Gross, we're still satisfied that the core of what we're looking for is still covered in the Dash 10 amendments, and we support that going forward. So we ask that you pass this out of your committee with due pass recommendations so that it can make it to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for being so brief. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much, and we'll let you get on to creating a park in Senator Starr's district. I'm sure he'll appreciate that. Okay, and that's everybody that is signed up to testify today on House Bill 3441. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3441. We do have two other resolutions that we would like to move out today. And so we'll open a public hearing and work session on House Concurrent Resolution 31. We have one person here to testify, Andrea Chiapella, if you'd like to come forward. And Lori, tell us about this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 31 honors Ashton James Eaton for outstanding achievements. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the measure, and it moved off the House floor with 58 aye votes and 2 excused.
Okay, thank you, Lori, and thank you very much for being so patient, and we're eager to hear your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Farrelly, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Chiapella. I'm here on behalf of Representative Conger, House District 54, representing Beautiful Bend. Ashton James Eaton, he is a native of Bend, and so we brought this resolution before you guys to honor his achievements in, on the world stage. He's a fellow Oregonian. He was from Bend, went to Mountain View High School, where he was a standout athlete, went to state, made a name for himself in high school. He went on to University of Oregon and was a 5-time NCAA champion in the decathlon and the heptathlon. He actually visited on the Senate side, as I'm sure you guys remember. Hopefully you all got a chance to shake his hand and meet him. He's actually a really nice guy. So he won the Bowerman Award in 2010, and some of you may know, but it was a high honor for a collegiate track and field athlete. And he set the world record in the heptathlon in 2010, broke it again in 2011, and yet again in 2012. So it kind of shows how exemplary of an athlete he is, breaking his own world record several times. In the decathlon, he scored 9,039 points and was only the second person to ever do so, and that was at the 2012 Olympic Trials in Eugene. So broke the record in Oregon, which is kind of awesome. Don't know if any of you got a chance to go actually see that, but it was kind of an amazing experience to have that take place here. And in 2012, of course, this is kind of why he's so well known. 2012 Olympics, he won gold in the decathlon, setting the world record, and now he's known as the world's greatest athlete. So this resolution, the purpose of it is just to recognize his achievements and in bringing pride to Oregon and Bend, and his achievements in discipline and dedication to the sport and to our community. And he's active and trying to promote, youth sports and everything, and trying to make his community a better place. So not only for sports, but also for activity involvement in the community. So I urge an aye vote. It passed unanimously on the House floor, and we hope that it can do the same in this committee and on the Senate floor. So
great. Well, thank you very much for being here and representing your boss, and certainly it was a memorable day that he spent early in session here. So
thank you.
Thank you again. And Senator Starr, I feel a motion coming on.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 31 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved HCR 31 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Motion carries. There are quite a few Senate sponsors on this, so I really don't know who.
I would recommend perhaps Senator Knope.
I see that Senator Knope is the chief sponsor, so how about if we ask him to carry it on the floor, and I will close the work session on HCR 31 and open a public hearing and work session on HCR 34. Lori, can you tell us about our last piece of business for today?
Happy to, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 34 honors Arden Hassinger for his service and sacrifice. There's no revenue or fiscal impact. It moved off the House floor with 60 aye votes, and Representative Mayor cannot be here today. But there is rather extensive and excellent background that came over from the House Administrator and House Rules, Aaron, and tells you the story of Chief Master Sergeant Hassinger.
Okay, well, it's certainly an important resolution, and it looks like a memorable person that we're honoring. So, Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the House Concurrent Resolution 34 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
And Senator Farrelly has moved HCR 34 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Motion carries. Do we have a volunteer to carry this on the floor?
Madam Chair, I would volunteer Senator Olson or Senator Boquist.
Okay. So how about if we just we'll assign it to Senator Boquist, and then if he has a friend that he wants to carry it, he'll let us know who that is.
Thank
okay.
you.
And so we'll close the work session on HCR 34. Members, we definitely have lots of business still pending, so stay tuned, and we will give you as much notice as possible of our agenda for our next meeting. Nothing further to come before us today. Thanks for all the work and your patience, and we are adjourned.